Ups, no. Joel, bet you ready?
Don't worry, I'm ready. Run back to the office. I stepped on you.
If you two can stop the bouquet toss and come up here, that. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for May the 1st, 2017. We are gathered together today for the purpose of a public hearing on Senate Bill 5540, the Oregon Department of Transportation Phase 2. The record should reflect that Senator Monroe is excused due to illness, and Representative Gomberg will be leaving us momentarily to testify on a fine piece of public policy someplace. And so with that, Mr. Jolivet, you have no particular opening comments. So we'll invite Team ODOT up in any particular order that you would like to. Good afternoon, Mr. Mather.
Good afternoon, Chair Johnson, member of the committee, Paul Mather, how are we doing, Administrator? I am going to be here with my one slide in my presentation to go over curb ramps and our settlement with Disability Rights of Oregon over curb ramps. I just put this one picture up there just so as I go through my presentation, there's another number of topics I'm going to talk about. I just want to make sure we're on the same page with the different aspects of curb ramps that I'm going to be talking about. So the ADA legislation, federal legislation, was passed a number of years ago, and during that time there has been a number of kind of issues that keep kind of changing as we go forward. One is the triggers. So the times when we do projects that quote-unquote trigger our need to or requirements to deal with curb ramps, one of the features of ADA, and the other is the various standards that apply to ramps. Have both those things have kind of ebbed and flowed or changed over their life of the ADA legislation. About two years ago, we had notice from Disability Rights of Oregon their intent to sue. As we have navigated, particularly the trigger portion of this, during the last several years, Federal Highway Administration at one point gave us direction that when we did our 2-inch overlays, maintenance overlays, that they didn't meet this trigger requirement, and we weren't required to do the ADA. And so we had done some projects under that guidance. That guidance has changed, now are required. Now are that does trigger our ability to or requirements to add the ADA ramps. Also, during this,
let me stop and ask you a question though. Do the ADA ramps? I understand that on a crosswalk where there is pedestrian travel, but I have seen these reconfigured ramps in some of the goofiest places, where nobody would use the sidewalk. And I went round and round with your department about the community of Linton, and I'm just right. Trying to figure out, are you required to do every single curb cut in the state, or what's the where that comes along with the threat of suit?
So, Chair Johnson, I'll get into that a little in my presentation, but we're required to meet the law and when we trigger, and one of the ways that we meet the law is to document a design exception or a reason that it is not required. There's an alternative route or other means to satisfy the legislation. So not in every single case do we have to, but we have to document our reasons why we didn't and why this particular case we took other actions or other mitigation actions. And I'll get into a little more detail how we're going to do that under the settlement in my presentation. So we were sued. We worked with Disability Rights of Oregon for, boy, the better part of 2 years. And last fall came to an agreement. That agreement was signed by a judge in March. And we are working to implement the various aspects of the agreement. So I'll touch on just a couple of the major elements of the agreement. This agreement applies just to state highways, so it doesn't apply to city or county or other aspects, but just to the state highway system. One of the things we must do under this agreement is to do an inventory of all our ramps. We have inventories at various times, but we need to get one set of inventory, which will be basically a benchmark that we'll build the agreement off of. That inventory needs to be done by the end of the year. We'll have 15 years then from when we complete that inventory to meet, address all those locations that were identified in the inventory. We also must hire an independent access accessibility consultant, and we're underway, and we've identified who that person is and going through negotiations right now. We also must improve our pedestrian routes through our construction work zones. We also agreed to $5 million of upfront money to kind of kickstart some of this work that we have. And finally, we must do annual reporting that we report back to them and post on our web page.
Mr. Heatherwood, was ODOT the only object of a suit? Because I have heard stories that the city of Bend was also sued and ended up forking over millions of dollars.
Chair Johnson, that's my understanding, too. This suit just applied to ODOT. Disability Rights of Oregon has, as I understand it, several suits with other public jurisdictions.
Have you monetized the cost to ODOT?
I was just getting to that. So if you take the roughly 15,000 inventory ramps that we have, we need to finalize that number, but it's going to be in the ballpark of about 15,000. Apply about a $10,000 cost estimate to each of those. That's about $15 million a year for the 15 years that we have to do the work. This is, again, work that we're required to do. This agreement puts a timeline on that. Typically, if we're touching our pavements when we should be touching our pavements, which is about every 20 years, we would get to these in a 20-year cycle rather than the 15-year cycle that that we agreed to.
Mr. Mather, were there any exceptions? And the reason that I ask is, again, I'll bring the community of Linton to the committee's attention. It is serviced by Highway 30, State Highway. And Eagle Scout did a project that was a ramp. And in front of the community center, beautifully done. I'm told that it was off by as little as a quarter of an inch, and it had to be torn up and redone. And my constituents were outraged that that had to occur. Is there any flexibility, or are these kinds of exacting standards being extracted out of ODOT everywhere you do one of these?
Senator Chair Johnson, that is the exact standards, and why the photograph that I've shown here have some of those exact standards on them. We have other examples of ramps that we've done recently we're also having to take out to meet these exacting standards. In our program development, in response to this, we have implemented new processes and new training for our staff as well as for consultants. So we're not in that position of having to rip these out that we can do them right the first time. But there are very exacting standards that we'll be held accountable for to meet these ramps. The other point I want to make is that consultant that we're going to hire, that is something we agreed to because of all the nuances and complications. And Chair Johnson, as you're talking about the exception process, we wanted that kind of neutral expert involved in the conversations between us and Disability Rights of Oregon to come to hopefully some of the more reasonable or better solutions in particular cases. And we have a person involved that can help facilitate that conversation.
Thank you.
The final point is that we'll be doing with ADA is really standing up a program similar to what you've heard me talk about with our bridge program and our pavement program. We're standing up that same kind of program discipline around ADA ramps. We'll be working with cities and counties and help passing along to them the lessons that we've learned and help them with training going forward, training our staffs, contractors, and building these. And really, again, putting that program discipline to ADA the same way we do our other programs.
Colleagues, any questions of Mr. Mather?
Yeah,
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I have a client that owns a commercial property that he was getting ready to get a permit to, and it's in the city of Portland, so I know it's not the same jurisdiction, but they are requiring him to put in these curb cuts for ADA, and they're making him pay for it out of his cost for this new development. And so I'm just curious, what's the difference between, you know, this and we have a couple of state highways going through my district in right. Milwaukee, Gladstone, and Oregon City. Do you work with the counties and the cities? Would that entail possibly through the rezoning or if somebody's getting a permit to require them to do that work?
Chair Johnson, Representative Beek, that's as developers get permits to provide accesses or improvements to the highway, we will be putting those ADA requirements into those permits, and they will be required to meet those same standards as they do their other work. What will be challenging for us, oftentimes their work will trigger other work in that same intersection, and we'll have to make sure we have the resources then to make sure that there's an ADA ramp, for example, on the other side of the street from the one the developer just put in, that we have obligations then for the other side, and coordinate those efforts.
Follow up. So then if there's a private property on the other side, but it's just aligned along the highway, will that be a lien on that current property owner, or is it just this is going to be an expense that the state takes on?
Chair Johnson, Representative Meek, will be responsible for that when that triggers. Unless that property happens to be developing at the same time, we'll be responsible for those triggers.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Mather, I want to make sure I understood you correctly. It's $15 million a year for 15 years?
Correct.
That, colleagues, totals up to $225 million. Yeah. And we're now in the process of trying to pull together a transportation package. This is what this has cost. And let me just establish my bona fides to have an opinion about this, having spent 6.5 months in a wheelchair. Oregon thinks of itself as being a little more disabled-friendly. But what this does is, than it really is, but what this does is to put these ramps in some of the silliest places. And I just want to call to your attention Senate Bill 268, which passed across our floor a few minutes ago, that once again invests disability rights with all sorts of special privileges because of their unique concern for disabled people. I'm quite concerned that this gives powers to a private not-for-profit that, I mean, already is costing at this point the state $225 million. Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So if I'm hearing this right then, so we could actually have some potential curb cuts and access in the middle of nowhere, correct? Is that right?
Sarah Johnson, Representative Beck, I'm not sure about the middle of nowhere, but wherever they're triggered will be required, and our projects will bear the biggest cost of this, whether it's a paving project or a bridge project. When those projects trigger, those added costs will be added onto a pavement project or a bridge project or other projects that we have, and so that will increase the scope of those projects as well as the cost.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair Johnson.
Okay. Anything else? Have you tried any of the exceptions processes? Again, I'm thinking about Linton and just how silly those curb cuts are. And now they've got signs up that say sidewalk closed. I don't know whether or not that ameliorates or mitigates what you have to do. Is that a sufficient prophylactic against having to do the curb cuts, where the curb cuts are probably worth more than a piece of sidewalk that goes from here to the back of the room?
Chair Johnson, we really haven't got in deep into that conversation. I think we have some ideas of what we can do there, but we've been waiting to get this consultant on board that will really help facilitate that conversation so we can do so, you know, in a productive way and then set some kind of protocols pieces that when our staff's out there looking at these, either through development or our projects, that we have some guidance in pursuing either a design exception or an alternative to putting in curb ramps when they could be very difficult to put them in.
I just want you to say the number again. This is
The number is, Chair Johnson, the number is an estimate at this point. We're going to do our inventory. But roughly we're about 15,000 ramps on our system. Could vary a couple thousand either way when we get done. The cost, I'm just using a ballpark number of 10,000. We have numbers that are as high as 20 or even higher, 20,000 or even higher on an individual ramp. But just do the easy math. Those are the numbers that we're looking at over a 15-year period.
Did DOJ settle this case, or was there any conversation about going to trial? mean, these numbers are just staggering.
Yeah, Chair Johnson, again, these are things we're obligated for. So really what we agreed to in the agreement was an accelerated time frame from maybe 20 years to 15 years. We agreed to this consultant. We agreed to $5 million up front. But these are requirements that the law requires us to meet. And so whether the number is 150 or 200 or $250 million, those are requirements that we're going to, that we're required under the ADA law to meet.
Okay. Senator Hanser.
Are you paying in the settlement disabilities, Oregon, disabilities of Oregon, excuse me, the advocacy group, anything?
Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, I don't have the details of the settlement with me to answer that question and get back to you on that.
Would you get back to the professional staff and they can share it with the rest of the committee? Representative Meek, Representative Reardon.
Representative Reardon, good.
Former shop teacher wants to know, when you come back in 5 years after Tanner and pave that again and the elevation of the street goes up higher and that throws off the angle, do we have to redo that corner?
Chair Johnson, Representative Reardon, usually our practice would be to grind out 2 inches of asphalt and put 2 inches back so those heights stay the same. Sometimes, as you know, in urban settings, that becomes more challenging. In some cases in our past, you'll see the center of the street actually rise up as we taper those slopes then back in so we don't have to change that curb elevation, not just for ADA, but the overall drainage system is also affected as we go against that curb.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad you thought of it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. One of my, I don't know how to frame this, but one of my clients had to put in new sidewalks in the city of Portland along a commercial aspect there. And the city sent him a bid, said it was going to be, you know, $20,000 to put in these sidewalks. He could either do them himself or have them do them by a certain date. He goes out and gets a bid, and they cost $2,000 to do that, and he saved $18,000. My question is it Oregon Department of Transportation that's going to be doing this work, or is it contracted out?
Chair Johnson, Representative Meek, we'll be doing it through our normal process where the design work is done by us or other A&E professional consultants that we hire, put out for bid, and then contractors will be constructing it. But I would point out with your example, so if you use my $10,000 cost example, the actual concrete and the work that a contractor would be doing is probably on the order of $2,000 of that $10,000. The other is the engineering work, the right-of-way work, all the little tiny nuances to get this just right in those corners so we can hold that contractor accountable for those dimensions. We've got to do a lot of individual work in each one of those corners. We're working to streamline that process so we don't have to do these kind of one at a time. But right now, the situation we're in, to meet those stringent requirements, there's a lot of engineering work that goes into and very little construction work. It's almost a flip of what the rest of the project is, where it's 80% construction work, 20% engineering. These are about a flip of that.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Yeah.
Senator Hansel.
Being a non-engineer, what is meant by the warp in that illustration or that picture?
Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, that's a highly technical term, just meaning that you're transitioning that slope from the existing sidewalk into that slope that's on there, the 5 to 8%. You're just matching that slopes of feathering or tapering or warping is the term that's used there to match into the existing sidewalk into that slope requirement into the curb ramp.
Colleagues, any other questions of Mr. Mather? Thank you very much. Next up, Mr. Lauer, our old favorite, the State Radio Project. Are you back for a guest appearance?
Yes, I am. Just this afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Lauer, Chief Engineer, retired as of this morning from the Oregon Department of Transportation. I got the mouse, I guess.
And colleagues, I don't think you're teasing it. You're effectively retired, are you not?
This as of this morning, today, May 1st.
And thank you for your service at ODOT for those many years.
Appreciate it, and thank you. What I'm going to do today is provide the closeout report for the state radio project. It's just a couple months away from formally wrapping up. Here we go. No, that's not the right button. Let's get this back up.
I would say, colleagues, that while Mr. Lauer hunts for the slides, that...
I'll use the buttons. It's much better.
Mr. Lauer has been a utility infielder for ODOT for a long time and has been handed some projects that were in trouble and has brought them home. And so he would be too modest to say that, but he got this one dumped on him and soldiered through to the end of it. So thank you.
It's been a challenging project, but with a lot of good folks from ODOT and other agencies. This is not an ODOT-only effort. I think we have done relatively well. On the slide that you see in front of you is some of the existing sites that we picked up, the kind of conditions that they were. The say that our radio system looked like it belonged in a third world country is an understatement. There's very dilapidated systems. And you can see on the right-hand side what we were able to do on many sites. We replaced over 5,500 mobile radios and vehicles and handhelds for both ODOT and for OSP, as well as the mobile portion of the corrections department. 118 ODOT and OSP offices were updated with the latest radios. We have 41 new sites that we added to the system to provide better coverage. We did 67 dispatch consults for ODOT and OSP who are part of this project. And we also, I'm in the wrong slide. I'm out of space in my own slides. Let me start again. We built 45 new towers, 29 new shelters, 40 new generators. That's the backup systems. These sites are meant to be operational if they're completely cut off from commercial power for more than 2 weeks. They have backup batteries and portable propane generators to keep them up and running and working. We upgraded the statewide VHF system, which is often the interconnect channel for all the different radio systems within the state, so that we could talk to locals and locals could talk to other locals in the course of a particular event. We did 143 digital microwave upgrade hops, new installation of a complete microwave system at 137 different sites. So that provided a modern digital connection that's paying huge dividends. And we provided narrowband repeaters at 168 sites and brand new antennas at 139. As you can see, there's the look of the 5,000 radios in the upper left that we put in for ODOT and OSP. We did upgrading the office systems, the dispatch consults, and the particular interest is that what's in the lower right is 12 portable reserve packages. They're in trailers. They contain radios, generators, and a whole array of miscellaneous tools. And these are pre-positioned mobile reserves that are scattered across the state in case of any emergency. They often go out for fire events and things of that nature, but they can go out in any emergency event, and they're useful to any of the public responders within the state itself. We had a number of partnerships to deal with 13 different agencies, over 42 sites. We do not uniquely own every site that we're on. We often partner with local governments and partner with them in other elements of their system. And we have partnerships even beyond what we're formally a part of the project. For example, the city of Salem now does the dispatch for Lincoln County. It was a cost-effective need for them where they didn't have to maintain dispatchers. Well, that connection is done via the state's microwave system between the city of Salem and Lincoln County, so that microwave system is playing dual roles for the functions that it has, and it has the capacity to do that. So it's not just the 42 sites that we have partnerships. We have many smaller agreements and how different pieces operate that we facilitate across the state. We've been able to build far greater reliability in the system. We operated a 99.999 level of reliability. That's what's needed by the OSP, so that system is reliable, operating, and available when an officer needs it. We improve signal coverage across the state and allow for greater functionality. We increased the, we've done many things in terms of opportunities and drills with local governments to ensure that we have emergency capabilities and have built our emergency response capability across the state. And we work cooperatively with other systems. For example, in the upper right, you see on the left-hand side, there are the battery systems that go up on these towers. They're good for 48 hours. They're the size of a freezer is the best way to describe them. And on the left side of that picture is one of the portable generators that exists up on these mountaintops in the buildings we put up there, so that they can generate their own power and can be independent. Sometimes we have others that need to be independent for upwards of a couple months because of snow and other problems that prevent us from getting up there. And in the lower point, that's actually a emergency response command center from the city of Portland participating in one of the drills that we've conducted along with all the other first responders across the state. There have been many of them in partnership with the our federal partners as well. So the important numbers for this committee is budget. And the budget for this project was $229,991,000. Spent to date is $223,000. That is as of the end of February.
$223 million.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. The project is set to end on June 30th, where we will completely wrap it up. And the budget remaining is $6,900,000. We are well on track. We will be on time and on budget with this project.
Mr. Lauer, what happens with the remaining over budget $6 million?
Most of that funds actually will be spent out here in the last couple of months. We're in the closeout of contracts and final payments that are going forward. It is our target to come in around $500,000 under budget on this project. So that $6 million is actually going to be spent out in meeting contract obligations that have incurred. In fact, as of date, we have closed out 208 of 217 contracts for this project. 882 work orders out of 890 of them. So these are the kind of contract velocity that needed to be done for the various elements of this project. 75% of the assets have been transferred from the project staff over to the maintenance staff. And that's not just ODOT, but that also is the partnering agencies of OSP and Corrections as well. And we will be completing the transfer of those items. It's actually going on right now. This data was as of the beginning of March. By the end of by June, all that equipment will be transferred over.
I want to ask you a couple of other questions.
Sure.
When this project was originally announced and first unveiled to Oregonians, as I recall, it had a price tag of about $600 million attached to it. Much has been scaled back over time. And so, what exactly have we purchased? And I'm not denigrating the work that you've done because I know the mess you inherited. But for $230 million, do we have first responders who can talk to each other inside a building?
Two old questions there. Let me start with what Owen was. It was about a $680 million estimate, as I remember. Not adequate for what was scoped. It was a complete trunk system, and it was fuzzy on whether it included locals or not. It was a very fuzzy idea of scope, and our best estimates, it would have exceeded $600 or $700 million by several hundreds of millions of dollars at least if we tried to build the original Owen concept. The project was scaled back to one that simply served the state agency responsibilities, not local government responsibilities. Or what I would typically call municipal and county systems. There is a difference in need and design between the statewide system and a municipal system. We do not attempt to achieve building penetration with the state system. We cover, and I'm going to say generally, and it may vary a bit, about 78% of the state, including a lot of the areas that the OSP wildlife enforcement agents have to cover. So we cover a lot of open ground on highways, and that is the intent of what the state police generally need and what the ODOT portion for road maintenance needs. That system does not attempt to achieve in-building penetration. For example, here in the city of Salem, they have 7 radio towers that serve it for both police and fire, and that fully has the capability of penetrating a building and coverage as it needs to for those kind of functions. Our radio system covers Salem in about 1.5 towers, so you can see there's a much lower density to our system. We're designed to cover large swaths of area rather than trying to be intense and have a density of communications. Now, we do make some exceptions. We do this building, and this is a very problematic building to try to do in-building penetration on. And typically, we do not try to do that. So what have we bought for it? Well, instead of trying to buy a system that was everything to everybody, we focused down on a system that focuses primarily on the needs of ODOT, OSP, and the mobile portion of the correction staff. Now, originally, this project was to do all state radio systems. Well, the state prisons have very unique radio systems, actually multiple ones that they're very much set on the footprint of the prison, and they want no communications in and out. What they have works for them, and there was no need to replace it. Forestry has a different system that deals with a lot of private contractors, air tankers, and things of that nature. They step back because they have a very different funding source for that kind of service. And though they are partners in the system, and we share sites, and we work hand in hand, and we keep them fully informed of what we're doing, forestry was stepped out of the original Owen concept. So we're really left with ODOT, OSP, and to a much more lower degree, the mobile fleet of the corrections department. And that is a need that is basically one that is a traveling need, not a intensified urban kind of environment. What we have for the system is a fairly modernized system. Now, to hold to that budget, we had to reuse things. So we might get to a mountaintop that had a fairly decent tower, but it was too short or didn't have enough capacity. We might have to build a new tower there. Well, we repurposed that old tower to another site that it could use it well, because we had some truly dismal towers on some sites, old sign bridges from the highway, telephone poles that were rotting out, all sorts of weird things up there, pipes that were just kind of stacked alongside a building to stick an antenna on. Well, we've been able to do well by modernizing those, but putting in those used towers and sites of that nature. We also took a lot of the buildings, so we look at the needs of a particular site, and it may needed a much larger building up on that site to house a generator, the amount of equipment needed to go in to service that area appropriately. Well, that old building was salvaged and kept, and was often put at some other site where it was reasonable, and it was, I mean, we had a dilapidated block structure that was leaking, and we had literally ones where when we first took it on, we had sites where they were wrapped in visqueen. Our radios were wrapped in visqueen because the buildings were simple block walls that leaked when the snow piled up against them, and it was a disaster for a radio system. So we put those good and still useful but maybe too small buildings on those sorts of sites. So we made the best economy we could. We were given a budget, a hard budget, and said deliver a modern up-to-date system with new radios, digital microwave systems, and advanced trunking systems within the valley where we had the highest traffic volumes within this budget. So we made the best use of the materials we did. There are things we might have liked to do, towers we might have wanted upgraded or whatever, but if we could live with them, we lived with them. There will be needs that will be still coming at you. The annual operating budget, and we put together 4 agencies, ODOT, OSP, Corrections, and Department of Forestry, set a committee. We have a new committee called the SHRUG, and they're basically the owners. And you think of them as a mini board of directors for the radio system. And between them, we all portion out what are we going to do in the next biennium. What systems have to be upgraded? What systems, you know, they're all computer systems. They don't sit static. We have to keep the investment viable. So they will be coming back to you year after year saying, here's what we defined as a need to keep the radio system functioning as it is, do modernization or upgrades that are forced on us by software vendors and things of that nature. And that will come, and then they're dispersing it amongst the agencies on what they can afford to do. So they're setting some of those priorities and setting it up as a part of their budgets as they've been coming to you in the future years. So we've tried to build some longevity. We've taken it from a dilapidated system to, I think, a reasonable world-class system that we have today. We need to maintain that investment because you've just put a lot of good money into it.
Do you have an estimate on the annual ongoing?
I do not.
You've got a bond right now that we're...
Right.
chewing up out of the highway fund, but eventually, and Mr. Mather, maybe you can help with this, eventually it shifts over onto the agencies. We don't have enough firefighters now for forestry. How's this? What's the ongoing cost going to be?
So, Chair Johnson, we're working on that, and we'll in our next budget, next meeting, we'll see us coming with limitation changes, at least to the highway portion. As you say, there's impacts then to state police and other aspects, as it's a cost-sharing responsibilities. But we'll be coming and laying out that ongoing maintenance schedule and just keeping the system upgraded. One thing is, as Tom pointed out, we don't want to go backwards and end up where we were. We need to keep investing in the system, but we also know we got, you know, financial realities in front of us. So we'll be having that conversation with you next meeting.
Safe to say, though, it's not an inconsequential number.
It is not.
And when does it drive towards system obsolescence? Because while Mr. Lauer managed to spin a little gold out of a lot of straw, when is this obsolete?
It doesn't happen in a day, and it doesn't happen at one time. Towers have different needs. We have a robust inspection on them if there's a cracked member or something like that. Remember, these towers sitting up in a very difficult environment on the top of mountains. They see very high wind loads, snow, ice, all those sorts of good things happen up there. You can see we use snowcats, crews specially trained to go up in emergency conditions to get there. And sometimes they can't because of the risk of snow slides, what do you call them?
Avalanches,
thank you. But, for example, the microwave system we put in early in the next decade will be out of manufacture. That doesn't mean those microwaves aren't good. It means that they'll go out of manufacture, and parts will be made for a number of years by that supplier. So somewhere in 2030, they will stop manufacturing. And then we will, you know, the plan is to say, okay, we have so many units. We have a very detailed maintenance log that we keep on all these parts and systems that we have. We likely go through these kind of parts, and so we'll stock up on them. But at that same time, they're going to have to start planning. If we've got a sunset on that particular microwave system, what are we going to do to replace it, and when will we start to do it? And that's part of what the Shrug Committee will walk through, how to stock up on spares so you can keep the system running. And then when do you have to replace it? Because technology or manufacturing is just moving on beyond it. And that's true of the radios and the vehicles, the mobiles that the officers have, and all the parts. But they all come at different times. So it's not a given day the system's obsolete. And if we make prudent investments, we can keep track of that. And the folks that run it are very much aware of both the supply issues and the functionality. And as I said, they're keeping detailed. We put in a very nice maintenance logging system, because we often share costs on maintenance, not to just ourselves, but the local governments. And we have to parse out those costs, so it enforces it on us. And so we can actually have a billing ticket every time we do maintenance. And so we know what parts are failing and what frequency they do it. And if we found a turkey part, you know, this one's failing at a high frequency, we know that one might be a piece of the system you need to replace. Did I answer your question, Chair?
Yes, sort of. A couple of other questions. Once a decision was made to scale back and only service the state agencies, is law enforcement at this juncture fully aware of the limitations of this system and the fact that it's a state system? Because I am aware of a recent shooting that involved an OSP trooper. Multiple jurisdictions responded. And were they able to speak to each other?
I have not done any research into that event. We can come back to you on those questions. But in terms of how the system was laid out in the coverage, we've worked extensively with OSP to know what their needs were. And in fact, often we would do drive tests with them or show them the results of our drive tests to say, here's the coverage we got along a particular highway or in a certain valley or range that were already known to be troublesome parts for the old system to keep up with. And so we ensured that they got the coverage they needed, even if we had to put in local repeaters or other equipment to make sure, or believe it or not, play with the antennas, because I learned there's a lot. Antenna is not just an antenna. They're very directional if you want them to be, and they can be focused in ways. So we worked heavily with OSP to make sure they had the coverage that they expected to have and needed to have. Is that complete coverage in all places and in cities? No. Now, in terms of locals, we did provide and continue to provide frequencies that are meant for interoperability amongst all the agencies. But beyond that, we are starting to, and I don't want to use the word merge, but partner system to system. The big systems in the state, like the one in Portland, the one in Eugene, the Southwest 7, Salem is looking to upgrade, Deschutes County is upgrading, where the main core, the heart, it's a big computer, can actually be patched into the radio system of the local providers. And so that our systems now can cross-communicate. And in the trunking world, which allows for very discrete operations, you can actually set aside a group that can be partnered between both OSP or any group of responders to come onto that channel and talk freely amongst them. We also, in buying the radios that we now use, basically, I refer to it as a common denominator. It has our radios, unlike most that are used across the state, have a very broad range of frequencies because we were operating in a broad range of frequencies across the state. So we can match any frequency a state agency or any agency is using and actually, with their permission, go onto their system. For example, at the state fair, OSP troopers actually patrol that. They actually, during that event, can tag onto the city of Salem system. And so they can have that interoperability as they need to. So we kind of build a universal denominator into our radio system.
Representative Noble, who may have spoken on one of these radios at some point.
It's possible. Thank you, Chair. Co-Chair. I think the more you talk, the more you answer my questions, which is really good. I'm curious, what spectrum is it operating in?
Well,
or are you in multiple
the answer
areas?
To you right now is
I know
men.
Enough to be dangerous. How's that?
Chair, Representative Noble, the immediate answer is many. And we have finished a trunking system, and I believe there are three mountaintops within the valley that are operating on it today. But we did not convert it all over because both OSP and ODOT maintenance wanted to wait till the snow season is behind us and also allowed us the opportunity to get to some of our mountaintops. So now, in beginning now and through the summer, we are moving to the 700 megahertz system, which is our digital system. It gives us superior communication properties in a digital world without crosstalk over beyond the end of your range that you may be familiar with the radio where in the old analog, it broadcasts out a long distance, but you only have effective communications at a shorter distance. Digital actually broadcasts at a shorter distance, but because it is in a digital packet, it actually comes through clear much farther out into its range. And then it doesn't have the crossover talk that you would see in an analog system. So we are moving, and in fact, this building will be moving to a 700 megahertz frequency trunked this summer. And that should give us better building penetration here. And we still may have to play with the repeaters because this is a very interesting building to try and put a radio signal through.
Follow up,
please. I appreciate that. My experience is both at Corvallis Regional PSAP and Yamhill County's PSAP and WACA.
Okay.
And familiar with some of the leased towers that you were operating on. And just curious about interoperability. I think it was a very wise decision to not do it at the infrastructure level as the original plan was, and I'm sure there probably are some of those connections because portables and mobiles are getting so advanced now to be able to do that. So I assume then you have mobiles that will allow for, or at least have the ability for people to have available to them both VHF, UHF, and then 7800.
The radios the state bought can cross all those spectrums.
Perfect.
I mean, they're no longer crystal radios where you have to have the right crystal. They're all computer. Those that are within the trunk area can actually be reprogrammed over the airwaves to take on any channel as needed. So if an officer said, I needed to, we actually have linked our system with Southwest 7, and if an officer said or ODOT maintenance says, I need to go onto that system and, he's got we have the right permission agreements done. That could be recrossed right over the radio, and that he could be given almost immediately that kind of service is available to him. Now, what the locals are buying is scattered lot. And in fact, many of them bought some of our, especially in Eastern Oregon, some of our older radios, which frankly will service them very well. I mean, the radio density, the amount of traffic in Eastern Oregon is at a much lower density than here in the Valley. And frankly, building a full trunk system there is not going to be cost effective, probably ever, unless there's radical changes out there.
Just a comment then. I just very much appreciate what you're saying. Being able to talk with Corvallis' trunk VHF and why Yamhill County's unique trunked UHF, and then can also work within the 7800, which is the standard pretty much everywhere else. It's not an easy thing.
No.
I would like to go back to your earlier comments about the question I had, and when Representative Noble mentioned Yamhill, it is unique to Yamhill. It was an OSP shooting. It involved Trooper Cederberg. And if there's any after-action report about that, I understand there may be a letter from Trooper Cederberg floating around someplace within OSP-dom. I don't know if you guys can get that. I would very much appreciate you getting that to the professional staff. And if you can't, on the letter that Trooper Cederberg wrote, could you indicate that you tried and...
Sure, Johnson, we'll follow up on that.
I presume it's a public document, and I presume we wouldn't have to scrap too hard to get it.
We'll follow up on that. Yep.
Okay. The other question, and this would be a particular interest to Representative Nierman, who actually knows how these big projects work, but was there any kind of an after-action written about, and again, I'm going to use a word that could be seen as pejorative, but kind of the collapse of the O-WIN project and then what you picked up and brought home? And the reason that I ask this is that you mentioned forestry was on this acronym that I can't remember, SNOOP or SNITCH or whatever it's
Shrug.
Called. Shrub.
Shrug. It's State User Radio Group.
Okay.
Shrug.
But you indicated that forestry, I think, had a seat on that?
Yeah, Commissioner Chair, yes, they did, because...
Let me tell you what my question is before you tell me why they earned a seat. They were in charge of helping to develop the business case early on, Mr. Nierman, and at that point in time, by my observations, were active saboteurs of the system. And I just don't know how you could have an agency that fought O-WIN as hard as they did now having a seat at the table making decisions of State Radio Project going forward. I'm struggling to reconcile that.
Chair, members of the committee, we've cultivated a very positive relationship with them. And at the point I took over the project, it was fairly obvious, you know, after action, what was the challenges with O-WIN? Well, we have multiple audits, and I'll be frank with you, I didn't burn a lot of energy and my limited budget on trying to find out what turned O-WIN wrong. That just wasn't productive to me. I had a system and a shoestring to deliver it on, and that's where we focused. And there are audits out there, internal and otherwise, that speak to what are some of the problems that we inherited. At some point, forestry has to look at upgrading their system. We do partner on a number of their sites. We obviously have contracts and agreements and relationships in the radio system that could benefit them. And so having them as a partner, even though we're not completely in, you know, they're still running an independent system, but having them as a partner at the table, and when it comes to the budget discussions, they don't have quite the voice that OSP might, or even corrections, who are paying members of the group. And I also can't forget the military department's Office of Emergency Management is also part of that group. Those are the main players when it comes to budget issues. But we talk about functionality and system opportunities. Not to be talking to forestry about remote sites and what's available they have and what we have and how do we work together. That's just a natural good way to do business.
And I appreciate that. I have a little logistical question here, if you don't mind. You guys are due back on the floor at 2?
Tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow. Okay.
And so we have 5540 scheduled for 2 days, but we're only going to have 1 hour tomorrow.
Good. I think it's incredibly important that we hear about Real ID and hear about it in some detail because of the significant consequences of that subject. How close are you to done, Mr. Larner?
My presentation is complete.
Okay. Well, again, I want to acknowledge your service coming in and picking up a mess, and I mean a real mess, colleagues, and delivering on it. And if you can get me the stuff from Yamhill County, I would appreciate that very much.
We'll do that.
I would also like to express to the chair and to various members of the legislature and oversight committees who were a part of us cleaning that up, and that was sometimes difficult, but it was helpful, and I appreciate the patience you had with us as we went through the whole process, and I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Well, and thank you for getting up, putting on a suit, and coming down here on the first day that you don't have to.
I did tell, do you really trust me to come here?
I was going to ask you for your unfettered remarks now that you were no longer tethered to ODOT by a paycheck, but that didn't seem fair with the director sitting in the back of the room.
Thank you.
All right. We will invite up ODOT.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation with me.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ben Kahn, Transformation Manager with DMV ODOT.
And we're going to tag team our way through this one for you. Thank you for having us. I know there are a few new members to this committee, so we're going to give you a little bit of background on why we're doing this service transformation program, or we're going to call it STP at some point, I'm sure, as we go through this. And also,
Let me just break this down for the time piece of this. The real ID, I don't know how long the service transformation piece is going to take with questions, but the real ID, colleagues, is going to affect all of us, particularly Senator Hansel, who has a military reservation in his district. So if we get through the service transformation, we could save the hour of tomorrow for real ID, because I want to leave plenty of time for questions. I think the legislature is going to be making some policy decisions around real ID, and this committee needs to have a thorough understanding of it.
Yes.
So does that work for you schedule-wise?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Mr. Jolivet, that work for you? Mr.
Co-Chair?
Cool. All right. Now, please, proceed.
So based on a consultant's report back in 2013, DMV developed a strategy for business process transformation and system modernization, and the business case identified some shortcomings in our current systems, and those include error-prone paper-centric processes that are complex and difficult to control and prevent errors. We have inadequate financial management tools, which is concerning since DMV is a major revenue source for Oregon's highway system. We have antiquated document management, including the use of, we continue to use microfilm, batch processing, and we have a lack of real-time information. We also find that our systems are difficult to use as we hire millennials to come in and do these jobs. They look at these mainframe systems and say, what is this? So it's very difficult. Employees with in-depth knowledge and skills are retiring as well. We have few online services, which our customers are concerned about. It's difficult in our current computing environment to have online services, and that affects customer satisfaction. And it's expensive to change our legacy systems. We see high fiscal analysis resulting from hours of programming that go into simple changes like a fee change. And so it's difficult to comply with state and federal requirements. In short, DMV cannot serve its customers well because we are saddled with inefficient business processes and obsolete technology. So a lot of planning and preparation work has been completed during the current biennium, and here are some of the highlights. DMV contracted with a vendor to identify and document a total of 165 business processes to capture DMV's current functionality and desires for a future system. The list provided critical input to the scope of work required for a system solution vendor to come in and do this work. With the help of more than 100 subject matter experts from many areas of DMV and ODOT, our project team and the vendor spent over 800 hours and identified more than 2,000 business requirements, which were included in the IS solution vendor proposal.
Let me stop you for just a second. Did you identify any of your customers? Is all I've heard is the internal DMV consultants and subject matter experts. What I want to know is, how about a car dealership that has to deal with you guys all the time? How about, because I'm told anecdotally, just in a small town, you know the guys that are around DMV, I'm told that in some of the paperwork, it's exceptionally easy to forge. That there are now rental cars that turn up stolen, and that you guys don't have the capability in your systems to identify that you're dealing with a stolen car until quite far down in the licensure process. So what I'm interested in, do you get any real, I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but any real businesses to come in and tell you how screwed up your system is, or did you rely only on internal DMV folks?
So, Chair Johnson, we have been meeting with our stakeholders and partners on a regular basis, including the state police, who have another project going on at the same time, and we're making sure that our systems integrate with each other. We've also met with the Dealers Association. We've met with a lot of other of our partners and stakeholders and have engaged them in our process. We have a bunch of folks that we interface with, and we're making sure that our interfaces continue to work in the future for these folks.
Could we have a copy, and you get it to the professional staff, of those advisory groups or lists of folks that you consider stakeholders? Wrecking yards, used car salesmen, new car salespeople. I would just like to see who you all consider your stakeholders and who you're getting input from. We're going to spend $100 million and take over a decade, which I still don't understand how this isn't, you know, building for obsolescence. And I just would like to know that you got input from guys that have to use this system, both frontline DMV counter workers as well as the folks that have to deal with you all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Coach Johnson, we will do that.
Thank you.
Provide you the list.
So in the information we gather from other states, we learned that not having your data prepared for the software vendor could be a roadblock to success. And so DMV IS employees have been working diligently to check DMV's database content for accuracy, completeness, and consistency. We've been looking at data formats, issues, and anomalies that are in our existing data systems. And once the COTS vendor is ready for data conversion, we'll have the data ready for them to import into the new system. So starting that work early allows us to avoid issues later on as the vendor comes on board and implements their new system.
Have you done any review of lessons learned from any of the other big IT projects, none the least of which would be OWIN, to see where you have issues? And let me tell you what informs my question, other than my knowledge of OWIN, is that apparently Department of Revenue's new system now is so complicated for people to use that it may be okay for the internal folks, but it's gotten just vexum for normal Oregonians to use. And I'm trying to figure out if in all this process work, you go from a two-page form to a 22-page form.
So, Co-Chair Johnson, we've learned a lot from other projects in Oregon as well as other states that have implemented modernization projects like ours. We've been following about 9 states that are either just have implemented or are in the process of implementing new technology for their DMVs. We're also looking at ourselves and the project that we did back in the 90s and learning a lot from that project.
Yeah, where you pioneered screwing up IT projects. I don't think any of you were around, but you were one of the early ones that trashed one.
So we learn a lot from failed projects. We learn a lot from successful projects. And I think it's important to look at all those projects.
Who do you hold up as a successful project?
We're looking at other states like New Mexico and Arkansas that recently went live with a new modernized system that meets Real ID compliance, and they've done it on budget, on time, and we've actually sent staff there to talk to their DMV staff and their project managers to learn more about those systems. And we're also looking and following other states like Washington State, who just went live with their vehicle system in December. Colorado went live in February with their driver system. So we're tracking those other states and learning from them and having conference calls with them.
Is it possible for you to pilfer from any of them so we're not starting with a blank piece of paper?
That's exactly what we want to do, Co-Chair Johnson. We want to be able to take advantage of what other states have done, not have to be the guinea pig to start over again, but to take those systems that they've implemented, buy a commercial off-the-shelf software solution that's been proven in another state, and implement that here in Oregon.
Yes or no answer to the next one. Are you building into this new system any contemplation of tolling?
That is, we have a list of 2,000 business requirements, and that is one of our requirements, so yes.
That just begs the question, because you answered it the way you did. Is it number 1,999, or is it like three?
So, Co-Chair Johnson, our goal is to implement a successful system based on our current needs. And if that is a need when we go live, definitely that will be part of the system.
We are right now discussing in this building the possibility of having tolling as an element in a new transportation package. I know, or at least I think I know, that ODOT's not very enthusiastic about that. Your answer is reinforcing my perceptions. You can respond or not.
Right, Co-Chair Johnson, it is one of our requirements, and we will make sure that it is elevated to the right place so that we have a successful system.
Should you guys be dumb enough to do this? You didn't say that piece. Mr. Director, are you going to come up and throw a lifeline? And in the meantime, Representative Noble.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I would just comment, since you're looking at both Colorado and Washington and, and elevating them as models, and they both have tolling associated with their systems, I think it would be a really easy one to keep high.
I think, Madam
Welcome,
Chair.
Mr. Garrett.
I appreciate, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I think first, our disposition is tolling is a viable financing mechanism. So I'm not quite sure where the concerns are that have been expressed that we have a poor disposition on tolling. We don't. We see it as an option. And I think we have been very forthcoming in the conversations to build the potential funding package that this is an avenue that we need to explore. Now, the realities are we are at square one. And we will build. We probably have 3 years just to understand the backroom conversation, to bring in the appropriate discussion about traffic and revenue analysis at that investment grade level here. So we have a lot of pick and shovel work to do. We have time. It's baked in the cake. We will be ready if indeed we animate an opportunity here that includes tolling, Madam Chair. And I want to make sure that's concerned. But I want to make sure that it's understood. We don't have a bad attitude about tolling. It is an option that, if indeed we get the right circumstance, we should pursue.
From 1,999 to 1,997. Thank you.
Baked in the cake.
Thank you, Mr. Garrett. Please continue. You might want to stay up here in case I got to throw you another lifeline.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, So, continuing on with our presentation, we have contracted with CSG Government Solutions, and they are a quality assurance vendor on the project, and they make sure that we have quality delivered in our IS-related projects for the entire life of STP.
So they're under contract right now?
They're under contract right now, CSG Government Solutions, and they're providing quality assurance services. They've been with us for over a year and a half now.
What are they reviewing?
So they are reviewing our requirements to make sure that they're complete. They're reviewing the other work that we've done in preparing for the vendor to come on board, our business requirements contractor, as well as they're helping to make sure that we have a robust contract and statement of work with the COT solution vendor that will be coming on board soon.
Help me. I don't speak fluent acronym. What's a COT?
So the commercial off-the-shelf software solution vendor. So they're helping us to make sure that we don't miss anything as we move forward. They were instrumental in helping New Mexico with their system, and they've been in Colorado doing quality assurance work there, and we're lucky to have them on our project as well.
Madam Chair, if I may, and this is a lessons learned from the statewide radio project, where you bring this risk management set of professionals in who help articulate, here's the pathway you have charted. Are you staying on that pathway? Are you making the decisions? We've gone to school not only with the state radio project, but also with the road usage charge as well. We find the third-party risk management protocols very effective in ensuring that if we say we're going to do this, they make sure they keep us in line, and it's an independent set of eyes that help inform that conversation.
Did you have a QA on quality assurance on the road users?
Yes, we did. Public knowledge was the...
Ah, yes.
Yep.
They reviewed all those travel vouchers.
No,
please continue, Mr. Chairman.
In January of this year, we entered into a contract with an organizational change leadership vendor to help create and execute a comprehensive organizational change management plan throughout the life of the program.
Let me stop you again. How many contracts do you have underway right now?
Currently, we have two contracts, one with our quality assurance vendor and one with our organizational change leadership vendor. We will soon have a third contract with the IS solution vendor.
What kinds of contracts are these?
These are deliverable-based contracts.
No time and materials anywhere.
Nope.
Right answer.
Again, we Co-Chair Johnson, we learn from the past, and we try not to make those mistakes again. So this organizational change leadership vendor will prepare our employees for change, and this has been identified as an important factor by our quality assurance vendor. So this contractor will help us make sure that our staff are ready for the change, doing internal stakeholder engagement, change readiness assessments, change impact analysis, employee training, and communications. We are committed to supporting our employees through this change. And a commitment has been made to DMV employees that no one will lose their job because of this transformation. However, employees must be willing to learn new skills or even a new job as part of this transformation.
The reason I'm smiling is that I worked for ODOT for a brief period of time when we had Service-O-Saurus, a inflatable Godzilla dressed up in a suit preparing employees for change. I mean, I couldn't make this stuff up. I just am hoping that the terms of this contract are a little more robust than Service-O-Saurus. Please continue.
Thank you. So much of the 2015-17 biennial activity was focused on putting the structures in place to inform and support the work of our IT vendor, who will provide the commercial off-the-shelf software solution that will replace our legacy systems. STP is procuring a proven solution, which means that only vendors with success in other jurisdictions installing both a driver and vehicle system met the requirements of the RFP. And a thorough evaluation process included vendor staff interviews, visits to jurisdictions where the product is in use, like Arkansas and New Mexico. And finally, the vendor needed to ensure that their proposal met DMV's business requirements. We've done some other preparation, including making sure that we upgraded our bandwidth at our 60 field offices. We're also working on creating more space within the DMV headquarters for the vendor and their staff to come and participate with us. And then we've also increased the parking at the DMV headquarters for those additional contractors. Several existing
the plan that they're going to be embedded at DMV and that will be their platform to do this work?
Right. They, Co-Chair Johnson, the vendor will bring in about 20-25 individuals. They actually will live in Salem for 3 years during the life of the program, and they will be located at DMV headquarters.
Is the vendor moving them here, or does the state of Oregon have any responsibility for that?
Co-Chair Johnson, the vendor covers those costs. Of course, they probably will pass those on to us, but yes, they cover those costs, those moving costs. And the company, which is Fast Enterprises, they're known for that, for moving into a location for 3 or 4 years and making sure that the work gets done.
So you've already identified a vendor?
We've issued an intent to award, and we're currently in contract negotiations with the vendor. And I can talk more about that in just a minute. We also have a lot of project team members that have taken on job rotations. So we've taken folks from the field to come into headquarters and help us configure the commercial off-the-shelf software solution. The next slide talks about governance, and we have a robust governance structure. The project team provides regular updates and reports to many groups on the progress of the program. We have the DMV management team that meets weekly and receives updates as needed. We have the STP Executive Steering Committee, meets monthly. It's chaired by Director Garrett and includes STP team members, ODOT executive managers, Legislative Fiscal Office, Office of the State CIO representatives, as well as CSG, our QA vendor. They attend that and provide updates to that group on a regular basis.
Who from the Office of the State CIO, who is that individual?
So we have Ed Erebus that attends on a regular basis, and we also have
Jared Chalk.
Jared Chalk, yeah, from the STO, yeah. And then we have the STP Oversight Task Force, and this came about from a budget note from last session from this committee. And so we created that STP Oversight Task Force that has three representatives and three senators, as well as some private sector CIOs. And they provide us insight and guidance as we move forward, and we meet with them on a quarterly basis. And then we also present to JLCIMT on a regular basis. And then we have the Oregon Transportation Commission that receives quarterly reports and in-person reports as well on a semi-annual basis. In addition to external transparency, DMV reports, or STP reports, to internal groups at DMV headquarters, including our STP leadership team, our STP Employee Advisory Committee, as well as our DMV User Council.
How much money have you spent to date?
Chair Johnson, that's a great question. To date, we've spent about $8 million, and Tom is going to go over that part in his budget slide. But yeah, it's about $6 to $8 million that we've spent so far on STP, mostly on those contracts to identify our requirements and to get our quality assurance and organizational change leadership vendor on board. Next slide has our StageGate deliverables. We've met StageGate 1. We got that approval back in April of 2015. We received StageGate 2 approval in May of 2016. And we are working towards StageGate 3 approval, which is required before we can sign a contract with the vendor. We're working closely with the state CIO office and LFO to ensure compliance with the StageGate process. And most of the artifacts required for StageGate 3 have been reviewed and accepted by the OSCIO staff and reviewed by LFO staff as well. I'm going to take a break from speaking and let Tom talk for a while.
Okay. So budget. The approved budget for the
Would
current biennium.
Would you introduce yourself just again now that
again?
You're speaking?
Okay. Tom McClellan, DMV Thank Administrator, you. Department of Transportation. The approved budget for the current biennium for this project was $30.4 million. It included estimates for software acquisitions that we likely wouldn't be purchasing because of the deliverable-based contracts, but it did signal very strongly to the vendor community that we were serious, that we were going to put some money out there available for their proposals. And we were able to get a lot of work done with the amount that we have. The top curved line of the chart is the estimated cumulative program spending over the 10-year period that was just mentioned. We anticipate spending by two-year budget period is shown in the lower dashed line. We anticipate spending $55 million by the end of next biennium. So up to $10 million this biennium, $45 in the next 2017-19 period, for a total of $55 million by the end of June of 2019. The first rollout of the COTS solution, commercial off-the-shelf solution, is scheduled to be completed, and the second rollout initiated during the next two-year period. So half of the total program expenditures, the $90 million that we've committed to, could easily be spent in the next two-year period. If the schedule proves too aggressive, we'll delay some contracted deliverables into the following biennium and just spread it out over the more biennium.
Mr. McClellan, how will you know that the schedule is too aggressive?
Chair Johnson, we're going to know by the pace of things, I'm sure. If we can't keep up, if things need to be slipped at some point, we're going to have to ease up a little bit on the schedule. And that's going to push out, because it's deliverable-based, it's going to push things out beyond the two-year period that we're looking at in 17-19. We'll lace up. We'll have the tennis shoes on and run as fast as we can. But there may be times when we have to slow up just a little bit and make some adjustments. Project budget, again, is $90 million over that period of time. So you can see it tapers off very quickly heading into 2021-23 time periods. Here's just a breakout of the $45 million that we do have in the governor's recommended budget. There's a policy option package of $27 million. The base budget funding includes the approved positions and ongoing costs of about $18 million. So again, total estimated spending is 45. The capital outlay includes software and hardware for both core and foundational systems, plus replacement of a major legacy system, the vehicle system, in that two-year period. We're not asking for any additional positions for 2017-19.
So in January, we issued an intent to award to Fast Enterprises. Fast has a complete integrated commercial off-the-shelf system with driver and vehicle components that has been implemented successfully in 9 other states. We are currently in contract negotiations and on the verge of signing a contract to launch the first rollout of the new system.
Were there any difficulties in those 9 states? When you say eventually deployed successfully, okay, great. Were there lawsuits? Was there any kind of ceasing work, any catastrophes in those 9 previous states?
Chair Johnson, there weren't any catastrophes, any lawsuits in those 9 states. We've actually polled all 9 states on whether they liked the system or not and what features they liked, and they all came back positive, 4 out of 5 stars mostly for those other states. We have seen lawsuits with other companies, but not with Fast Enterprises. So we are on the verge of signing a contract. We're still in the open procurement process, and so we can't talk specifics about the contract at this time. But what we can share is it is a deliverable-based contract. It's not time and materials. As part of our evaluation process, again, we went to other states where this product was in use. These states achieved positive outcomes. In fact, in New Mexico, they were going live with the first phase of their new driver system when we arrived. We went there when they were going live with their new system, and they were confident enough to have us there because they know there wouldn't be any problems with that system.
Maybe that's a good place on this optimistic note. We'll start with you guys tomorrow.
Yeah.
And wrap this up. I think you've got 4 or 5 slides left, and so we'll start here tomorrow. Colleagues, any questions of this panel? All right, Mr. Joe Levitt, any words of wisdom? Colleagues, anything for the good of the order? We're adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.